Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So this is episode 42. And in this episode, I wanted to just take you through six common hormonal imbalances that we face in our 40s as we move through perimenopause, and how we can support each one. So I've talked about these, the ones that we're going to go through today, in many episodes. All the previous 41 episodes, I've touched on them. But this episode, I just wanted to bring them all together, create this sort of nutshell episode where we just talk through the six most common hormonal changes that result, that we go through in our 40s, and how we can support them. So the first thing to say before we move into those is that in our 40s, it's not a time for us to do the things that we did in our 20s and expect things to be the same. Our hormones have changed now, and it's likely that our habits need to as well. So this entire podcast is, of course, about supporting your body, your hormones in your 40s. And this is what I bang on about all the time, and I will continue to. But it's just so important to understand that things like skipping meals, fasting until lunchtime or late morning, doing a ton of HIIT or HIIT style workouts and cardio or other random intense workouts throughout the week, pushing through even when we're feeling exhausted and that our body is genuinely saying no, but we just push through anyway because we need to get this done and we have to do this. None of this supports our hormones anymore. Obviously, at a time in our 20s when maybe none of this stuff was helpful then either, but our bodies and our hormonal system basically was in a much more robust state that it could, you know, we could probably get away with all of this stuff back then without it causing any sort of detrimental effects. But now they will create detrimental effects. It's really just kind of wrecking our hormones at this stage. Your hormones and your nervous system is just so much more sensitive and responsive to our environment, which includes our eating habits, our exercise, our sleep habits, our stressors, and our own unique life loads and, you know, different things that are going on for us. And now our body's really craving stability and calm. Our hormones they're looking for nourishment from proper nutrition, good rhythms, good sort of routines, good sleep rhythms, and recovery time. Now just isn't a time for the chaos, routines to be all over the place that we may have got away with in our 20s. So feeling tired, feeling foggy, feeling groggy, bloated, lethargic, anxious, or just not feeling like yourself anymore, that isn't just simply a part of aging. It's more than likely our body's way of asking us for help. Your hormones are asking for nourishment, they're looking for support, and they're asking you to make changes if you're experiencing those sorts of symptoms, which is very, very common, you know, as we move through our 40s. So let's take a look at each of the six common hormonal imbalances and how we can support each one. So the first one I've got here is low progesterone. So the first thing that starts to happen as we move into from our late 30s, anywhere from late 30s onwards, and definitely early 40s, is that progesterone starts to decline. This usually happens before there's any changes to estrogen. So progesterone is our calming anti-anxiety hormone. And so when we start, you know, when it starts declining in the body, we're also going to start noticing things like anxiety, potentially could be new or worse, sleep issues, maybe trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, that maybe weren't there before, spotting before your period that maybe wasn't occurring until now. So by spotting before your period, we basically mean, just noticing some blood, whether it's brown, even if it's red, before your period actually arrives and that full flow starts, which would mark day one of your period. So anything that happens before that actual genuine day one flow is spotting. You might notice shorter cycles by one day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and then heavier periods, because Progesterone, not only is it your calming anti-anxiety sleep support hormone, but it's also our period lightening hormone. So we would normally have a heavier period on the months where we haven't made much or any progesterone. When our next period comes, it's usually going to be heavy. It could be flooding. It could come with clotting because progesterone helps to balance out estrogen and lighten the bleed when it does come. So the top tips to support low progesterone are, you know, although it's a natural biological, you know, physiological thing that we do start to have this decline in progesterone, we can still support that decline because the way that we make progesterone is by ovulating. And I'm going to talk about this way more in the next episode, but in a nutshell, that's how we make progesterone. And although it is essentially normal, as normal physiology, as we move, the further we move through perimenopause, to ovulate less or not as optimally, cycle after cycle after cycle, the further we move through our 40s, we can support ovulation to occur many more months than it would have done. And we can also support the quality of our ovulation to make it better than it would have been if we just don't bother intervening at all. So the top tips to help ovulation actually occur so that we do make progesterone and or to make ovulation happen more in a more quality sort of way and therefore make more progesterone than we would have in that ovulation are, the top one would be managing stress. So supporting your nervous system and managing stress. This basically means doing things that, you know, nourish you, nourish your soul, nourish your body, and tell your brain, most importantly, things that tell your brain you're safe, that it's actually a fine time to ovulate, because your brain is always scanning for threats. It's always scanning your environment, external and internal, looking for any threats that could put essentially a baby's life at risk. But although we want to ovulate to make progesterone, you know, fertility aside, we're looking to make progesterone, but the brain doesn't know that. So the brain's always looking for threats. So anything that sort of tells the brain that we're calm, we're safe, and that's essentially your typical sort of nervous system support and stress management things. So the top things, because I've talked about this in, you know, I've got separate episodes on how to manage stress and support your nervous system. But for the sake of this particular episode, where my top tips for supporting stress in this instance would be to have a deep breathing practice every day, even if it's just 3 to 5 minutes, once or twice, preferably twice a day. So say at the morning, first thing upon waking, and last thing at night. Something like the 4-6 breathing ratio is my favorite. It's so simple, breathing into a count of 4 and out to a count of 6. So easy to do. You don't need to switch on a particular, you know, guided meditation or anything. You can literally just do it yourself. Saying no more. You know, how often are you saying yes when actually what you want to say is no, but you just want to please that person. You don't want to upset anyone. You don't want to rock the boat. So you just say no. You just say yes. So saying no is, you know, when you want to say no, is definitely going to be more helpful for your nervous system. Getting out into nature much more than you do, if you do. So any sort of, you know, detours that you can take on commutes or journeys or anything that you have to go and do, any errands, how often can you just get yourself into nature mindfully, you know, ideally not listening to anything, actually taking in the sights and the sounds of nature, even if it's as simple as sitting in your back garden, if you're lucky enough to have one that's full of nature. And try magnesium glycinate. So magnesium glycinate is the most calming form of magnesium that we can use for our nervous system. So I love using this particularly at night, about an hour or half an hour before bed. It doesn't make us drowsy or sleepy, but it does support a better night's sleep because it's so helpful for the nervous system. It's a really restorative mineral and the form of magnesium glycinate particularly. So I like to suggest sort of 300 to 400 milligrams of magnesium glycinate a night. Now, obviously, I only suggest supplements to people I'm working with one-to-one. Because, you know, I don't know what sort of medication anyone is on. Certain nutrients can interact negatively with certain medications. So do check if you're on any medications, check with your doctor or your health practitioner that it's safe for you to use magnesium glycinate alongside that. And then, number two, so the second most common hormonal imbalance is high estrogen. So we get that decline in progesterone first, and then estrogen, contrary to popular belief that it's declining as soon as we're perimenopausal, that's not the case. the decline usually happens later. So we're moving into perimenopause from sort of 35, late 30s upwards. We're seeing this decline in perimenopause, in progesterone. And then estrogen is actually on the rise. So estrogen can now start to rise to levels 3 times higher than they've ever been before in the body as we move into perimenopause and through it. And that decline in estrogen usually starts later in the later phases of perimenopause, which, you know, we can't always go by age for everybody, but roughly in the average person, that would be from sort of mid to late 40s onwards. Before then, it can be really high. And that sort of increase, that sudden increase in estrogen to levels that we've actually never had before, can start the sort of experience of heavy periods, clotting, flooding, breast pain or swelling or tenderness, that menstrual bloating and puffiness, irritability, mood swings. Some of these symptoms can also be linked to low progesterone because, as I said earlier, progesterone balances out estrogen and helps to thin our periods and prevent sort of menstrual bloating and irritability and things like that. But the fact that, you know, even if let's say we do have normal levels of progesterone, if estrogen's going really high, we can still get these symptoms. And it would just be worse if we don't have enough progesterone as well to match it and sort of balance it out. So when it comes to estrogen, we need to use it and lose it. We use that molecule in the body and then we have to get rid of it straight away. And this is happening 24/7 in the body. We need to make sure that we're losing it straight away so that it doesn't build up or sort of remain in your system. So that is one of the most effective ways to manage the fact that we have higher levels of estrogen. We want to make sure it's efficiently being detoxified, broken down, and then detoxified and cleared out of the body permanently. So top ways to support this are to support your liver, because your liver deals with the first sort of two phases of breaking down that used estrogen and detoxifying it. And then once it's done its two phases, it then sends it to the gut, where we'd call the gut regular bowel movements phase three, because it then sits in the gut waiting to be passed out of the body permanently. If it doesn't get passed out of the body permanently via say, you know, at least once daily bowel movement, it can get reabsorbed back into the body and come back into our system. So even though the liver might be doing the first two phases really well, if phase three, the gut isn't working very well because we're not having daily healthy bowel movements, or we have imbalances in the gut microbiome where we have levels of like higher levels of various bacteria that can send that estrogen back into the body, then, you know, we're just going to end up with this extra estrogen in the body at a time when it's already really high. And that can increase those symptoms I've mentioned, heavy periods, breast pain, menstrual bloating, irritability, mood swings, and even drive fibroids. So top tips for supporting the liver and the gut all at the same time really are lots of colourful, a diverse range of colourful vegetables, different types, not just relying on the same old vegetables, you know, every single day, the same old salad leaves every single day, really trying to diversify your salad and vegetable intake on a daily basis. So all the different colours, the purples, obviously, of course, your lovely dark green leafy stuff, whether that's your sort of rocket, watercress, spinach, you know, lamb's lettuce, all these different kind of dark green leaves that we might use as a base of a salad, kale, but also the sort of vegetables, typical leafy greens that we might cook, like cabbage, green cabbage, kale, chard, you know, what else? All the kind of, just all the sort of dark leafy green spinach that, you know, that you see in the supermarket. So making sure we're getting loads of those, but then adding a diverse range of colours. So your purples, your oranges, yellows, you know, red, yellow bell peppers, purple cabbage, purple onions, you know, all of these different colours. And then sort of sweet potatoes, you know, butternut squash. So you're looking at sort of the orange stuff, the different colour berries, different types of berries, nuts and seeds, beans, lentils. These are wonderful fibrous foods that your gut bacteria really love, but they also provide lots of different sort of known as antioxidants, phytochemicals, plant chemicals that support the liver's phases one and two of estrogen detox. And I have talked about estrogen detoxification in detail on previous episodes, so do go back and listen to them if you haven't already. other ways to support the liver and the gut to clear out estrogen are to have a high intake of cruciferous vegetables. So these are things like kale, rocket, watercress, broccoli, cabbage, all the different colours of cabbage, Brussels sprouts. These are really, like, if you make these the foundation of your vegetable supply, particularly broccoli and cauliflower, foundation of your vegetable supply, preferably on a daily basis, and then adding in all those other different colours and types of vegetables and berries and nuts and seeds and beans and lentils on top of that, then you're onto a winner. Ground flaxseed, a couple of tablespoons a day, 1 to 2 tablespoons, really helpful for getting estrogen out of the body. Also, the flax oil is quite helpful for the liver's phases of estrogen breakdown as well. And then, of course, having daily bowel movements. And all of these things will help with daily bowel movements and help with the your gut microbiome and the balance of bacteria there. But other ways to support healthy bowel movements to making sure that you're chewing every single mouthful really, really well of your food before you swallow it, because that is one of the most important things we can be doing to make sure we actually break down our food properly and digest it. And that is really supportive of daily healthy bowel movements. And remember, we're doing this because we want to make sure that that used estrogen doesn't stay in the body if it's, you know, just sat in the bowel and doesn't go anywhere. And then keeping the gut hydrated, so making sure you are drinking enough water, around 2 liters a day, just really supporting that hydration as well. And then the third common hormonal imbalance is that estrogen is erratic. So we've got low progesterone, then we get this high estrogen. So together, the high estrogen and its erratic nature, now it goes on a roller coaster, bringing about certain symptoms. So this kind of erratic, sharp highs and lows of estrogen that we now start to get that we didn't have in our 20s, our 30s, that starts to result in symptoms of both high and low estrogen all in one day. So if we have this big surge of estrogen at one point in the day, you know, we're going to get the typical high estrogen symptoms I just mentioned, like mood swings, irritability, breast pain, heavy painful periods when they arrive. But then low estrogen symptoms on the same day could be hot flushes, night sweating, again mood issues, particularly anxiety, irritability again. So it's all in one day, getting all of those symptoms all in one day as we move through perimenopause, which is what confuses a lot of women, because as soon as we start to have a hot flush, we start experiencing hot flushes or night sweating, we can just assume it must be low estrogen. So you hear loads of women, you know, early 40s, even late 30s, saying, oh, my estrogen must be low because I'm having hot flushes or night sweats. But actually, this is the roller coaster. This is more likely to, obviously, it's not always in every single woman. It could be that they have low estrogen at that point in their life. But for the majority of women, it's the fact that they're on this roller coaster now, and these lows, these sharp drops of estrogen are bringing on, you know, a hot flush, a night sweat, your typical sort of low estrogen symptoms. So top ways to support the roller coaster nature of estrogen are, come back to stress. It comes back to stress and nervous system support. The same things we do to support the body to ovulate and make progesterone, the same things we want to do to support the roller coaster. It makes such a big difference to the sharpness, the intensity of the drops specifically. It really helps to sort of take the edge off, I like to say. So all of those things I've already suggested that support you know, ovulation, because they support stress, will also support this. So again, just to recap that, you know, say no more, stop people pleasing, do you a little bit more, have a deep breathing practice, even just 3 to 5 minutes once or twice a day. I love that 4-6 breathing ratio routine. It's so easy. Get out into nature a lot more mindfully, and try magnesium glycinate as well. The fourth common hormonal imbalance is dysregulated cortisol. So declining progesterone and erratic, ever-changing estrogen levels now starts to have a big impact on cortisol regulation. So the new erratic nature of estrogen, it stresses out the brain. The sudden sharp drops can result in the brain sort of signaling to the adrenal glands to release stress hormones, because it's the brain is perceiving some kind of danger here. And that, of course, increases cortisol levels, because that is one of the stress hormones that's released by the adrenal glands. And then if we remember that progesterone is calming, it's calming, it's anti-anxiety, it calms the nervous system and supports our stress resilience. So progesterone's decline causes that nervous system dysregulation, and then again that stress hormone signaling by the brain telling the adrenal glands to release more cortisol. So symptoms we might notice here are anxiety, mood issues, you know, emotional dysregulation, low mood, irritability, feeling less tolerant to stress or less resilient to any sort of stresses or things that may not have been perceived as stress by you before, is now just really stressful and something that you just don't feel tolerant of. It might be low energy and fatigue, feeling tired but wired at night. So we really, really want to sleep, but we're just so wired that we can't fall asleep, but we're absolutely exhausted. That's very common. Struggling to fall asleep and stay asleep. 3 a.m. wake ups can be a suggestion of high or dysregulated cortisol. Muscle and joint aches and pains, very much linked to cortisol. Increases in belly fat, very much linked to cortisol. So one thing that cortisol does when it's in, you know, perceived stress in from your environment is that cortisol has the ability to break down your muscle tissue and turn it into glucose to send that glucose into the system to support that stress, which in that moment we don't need. We actually don't need this extra glucose because we're not trying to run to say, you know, run or fight a tiger, for example, to save our lives. We're actually just people pleasing too much, or, you know, essentially going through this physiological phase of perimenopause where cortisol is increased. So that can lead to increases in belly fat. So my top tips here would be to make sure you're eating minimum of 30 grams of protein, ideally 30 to 40 grams of protein within an hour of waking. So avoiding these sort of long overnight fasts, that book fast Like a Girl, not helpful in this phase of life. It just isn't. So really trying to get that 30 to 40 gram dose of protein in within an hour of waking, that prevents your stress system from thinking that you're starving. And starting to release cortisol to help mobilize that glucose into your bloodstream for survival that you just don't need. So instead, get in there with protein to let the brain know it doesn't need to do that. Those long morning fasts are just not helpful for us women in our 40s and beyond, from mid 30s, actually, I'd say. Maybe we could do that in our 20s, but definitely not from 40 plus. So by stabilizing your stress response in the morning, you're really setting the tone for the rest of the day. And then the other way to support this is really, of course, stress management, nervous system support, all the things I mentioned already for low progesterone and the erratic nature of estrogen. The fifth common hormonal imbalance is insulin resistance. So this is when your cells in the body and the brain start to ignore the action of insulin. So insulin tells your cells to allow sugar or glucose, also known as, into the cells, where it can be used for energy instantly or it's going to be stored for use later. Now, when the cells become ignorant or resistant to the action of insulin, it means that that glucose now has nowhere to go. And so it remains in the bloodstream because the cells aren't, they're just ignoring insulin. They're not taking in that glucose. Now your body produces more insulin because in response to this glucose remaining in the bloodstream, but your cells are simply resistant to it. So this poor old insulin, it has to store that glucose somewhere because that's its job. And it's like, look, I'm here, I have to do this. So it stores it in your fat cells because it can't get it into your body and brain cells, you know, your muscle cells, for example. So instead, it just shoves it all into your fat cells because it's dangerous to leave glucose remaining in the bloodstream. When glucose can't, so that's one reason why we would have this increase in belly fat as well. That's why insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes usually leads to excess belly fat. And then the other thing is that when glucose can't get into our cells in the brain and the body, we can experience symptoms like brain fog, brain fatigue, confusion, head can't think clearly, you know, that sort of foggy head, headaches, even migraines, energy crashes, cravings. And again, as I said, that's increased belly fat. So top tips to support insulin resistance, as well as having that 30 to 40 gram dose of protein for breakfast I just mentioned for cortisol support, make sure you're definitely doing that for insulin as well. Make sure you're also having the same dose of protein with your lunch and with your dinner and trying to avoid snacking in between meals. If we're eating enough food 3 times a day, we shouldn't need anything in between those meals. If lunch and dinner, for example, is going to be a very long gap, so usually we can have a decent gap you know, good gap between breakfast and lunch. But sometimes, depending on our commute or our, you know, routines in the evenings, it might be that lunch was, say, 1 o'clock, but dinner's like not till 7 or 8. And that could be, that's a quite a big gap. So I understand why we do need, we will need a snack in between that meal to bridge that gap and prevent our blood sugar from dipping too low. But we want to make sure that that snack would be protein based, as opposed to like just a, you know, a cracker or a biscuit or a piece of fruit. We want it to have some protein and preferably some good fats as well. So top tip for supporting blood sugar balance, which supports insulin resistance, is those 3 square meals per day. And then go for a walk after your meals. This is a top, top tip. So even just 10 minutes walk, 10 to 15 minutes walking after a meal is shown to significantly improve glucose uptake by the cells in the brain and the body. And therefore that helps to improve or reverse insulin resistance. This is especially important once estrogen levels do start to drop in our later 40s, closer to reaching menopause, because estrogen keeps our cells sensitive to insulin, which prevents insulin resistance. So insulin resistance is when the cells ignore the action of insulin. Insulin sensitivity is the opposite of that. It's a good thing. It's when the cells are very responsive to insulin and they happily efficiently take in glucose. And then we don't have that insulin resistance situation. So really, really important to be supporting insulin resistance, especially when estrogen is declining. But once we're on the roller coaster, even in the early perimenopause stage, we really want to be supporting this one. And then number 6 is low melatonin. So melatonin is our sleep hormone. It comes when cortisol gets low. So we don't want the two together. We can't have the two together. The brain starts to make melatonin in response to low cortisol at night, in response to darkness at night, which then comes along to facilitate a good night's sleep. Melatonin tends to naturally get lower when estrogen declines. And also if we have a poor nighttime, sort of morning, nighttime routine, habits that we do at night, in the morning, if that's not conducive to sort of, you know, healthy melatonin levels at night, then that will start to naturally decrease our melatonin levels and then impact our sleep. So symptoms of low melatonin would be trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, feeling tired but wired, I mentioned already, really exhausted but you just can't sleep, usually because cortisol is high at a time when it should be low. Waking up feeling unrefreshed in the morning, even if you've had what you think is a good night's sleep, and that would be because your sleep actually wasn't, it was quite light and it wasn't restorative, even though you might have felt like you slept for sort of 8 hours. So my top tips for supporting low melatonin are that to remember that melatonin gets its cues or its sort of instructions from light and darkness. So we want light exposure, daylight exposure in the mornings within an hour of waking, or at least within, ideally within 30 minutes of waking. But we want dark cues at night. So from early evening, start to dim the lights at home. At that point, stop using your overhead lights, bright lights, even if you're just going to the toilet or in the kitchen. Try to use sort of dimmer lights, you know, lower level lamps instead. And then stop using your screens an hour before bed. And that also includes WhatsApps, emails, everything. Really try to go completely without that for an hour before bed every night. And let people know if you need to, you know, let people know, by the way, I won't respond if a message gets sent after this time. I'll respond the next day, not first thing in the morning, but some point the next day. Let people know that. Everyone, every like important person in my life knows that about me. They know how to get me in a major emergency because they know that I'm not on WhatsApp or Instagram DMs or anything like that after a certain time in the evening. For me, it's usually about 7:30, 8 o'clock. But for example, my sister knows if she needs to contact me in an emergency, if she was to send a text message, that I do get text message notifications. And I don't mind that because I hardly ever get texts. Who gets texts these days? But if my sister needs me, she can phone me and she can text me. But she just knows that, you know, if we're just having WhatsApp conversations, that after sort of 7:30, I won't reply until the next day. So things like that really, really make a difference. And, you know, if you're just dying to check an email, just try to tell yourself, I don't need that email, will be there tomorrow if it's there now and I can check it tomorrow. I don't need to check it before bed. Don't be checking the news. Don't be scrolling through, you know, social media news feeds, because you just don't know what you're going to see. And anything that kind of excites us or stresses us out or makes us fear, gives us any kind of fear, and there's a lot of that to, you know, these days, before bed is not a good time to be exposed to those sorts of things, because it's just increasing cortisol levels. Same way, we don't want to be having deep, stressful conversations, maybe about finances. I had a client once who had a really nice evening routine when we talked it through. And then she said to me, then the one thing I do in the evening is it's a time for me and my husband to sit down together once the kids are in bed, about 9 or 10, and we have a conversation about our finances. That's when we have that conversation. And so that, you know, was a kind of red flag for me, because I thought, okay, well, everything else was looking really nice for her evening routine, very sort of nice wind down. But then when she said that, I said, okay, well, what these conversations entail? And, you know, she was saying finances aren't good, and it's when they sit down and talk about what they can do. And I said, well, how do those conversations make you feel? And she said, well, they're very stressful, they're very sad, they're very hard. And she's doing that every night before bed. That was the biggest reason why she was having trouble falling asleep and staying asleep. Because after a conversation like that, cortisol was spiked at a time when it should have been on the low, and melatonin should have been taking its place. And she was feeling anxious. That was the last thing in her mind before she went to bed. So we had a discussion about, could she change this, you know, the timing of this conversation to earlier in the day with her husband? And her husband works from home, so they both agreed, she had a very supportive husband, they both agreed to have this conversation in the morning after the kids had gone to school. They would sit down and talk about it, and then he'd get on with his work at home and she'd get on with her errands. And that significantly changed her sleep. So being really, really mindful of what we are exposed to, what we're talking about, who we're talking to in those hours, those really crucial hours before wanting to go to bed and fall asleep. So as well as that, as I said, make sure you get into natural daylight within about 30 minutes of waking up in the morning, because that tells your brain it's time to actually allow cortisol to rise, which is what we want. This is known as a cortisol awakening response. I have talked about that on previous episodes. We want this cortisol awakening response, also known as a CAR, if we were to do some testing, which I do a lot. We want that to wake us up in the morning and get us driven for the day ahead, but we don't want it to be high at night. So those are the 6 common hormonal imbalances. So I'll recap them. It is low progesterone, high estrogens, erratic estrogen, this roller coaster, dysregulated cortisol, insulin resistance, cells becoming resistant to the action of insulin rather than sensitive, and low melatonin. So hopefully that's given you a nice kind of nutshell approach to the what's happening in perimenopause as we move through our 40s, and just some top tips to support them. In previous episodes, I've gone into way more detail about each and every one of these, and, you know, really gone into more detail about how to support them. But this one hopefully is just giving you a nice top level of the most important key things we can be doing to support all of this. And as you can see, there's a lovely overlap anyway between all of them. One of those overlaps, the biggest overlaps, being stress support, nervous system support. So if you really feel that you need actually more support with how you can support stress in your nervous system, do go back and listen to previous episodes where I've really specifically gone in on those things, and you'll see that from the titles, the episode titles. So as ever, thank you for listening. And if you've got any questions, if you've got anything you want to share, any ideas for future episodes, any questions you'd like me to answer on an episode, I've really enjoyed answering listener questions on certain episodes. Sometimes I'll do 2 questions in one episode, and most of the time I actually dedicate the whole episode to one question, depending on what it is. So do send yours in if you want me to do that. So you can email me at francesca@francescaliparotti.com. You can DM me on Instagram, and all of those details will be in the show notes. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit, and consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy, or you'll also find the link in the show notes.